The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Welcome to the Georgene Rice Show podcast. This program was originally broadcast live on 93.9 KPDQ. We hope you enjoy the show.
Well, good afternoon and welcome to the Wednesday edition of the Georgene Rice Show. James Blind is producing, Clark Hilton engineering today's program. This hour, we'll talk with K.J. Ramsey, author of This Too Shall Last, Finding Grace When Suffering Lingers. It's beautifully written and very deep. We're going to try to do it justice in our conversation later this hour. K.J. Ramsey is a licensed professional counselor, writer. She's a recovering idealist, as she describes herself, who believes sorrow and joy coexist. Her writing has been published in a number of places, Christianity Today, Relevant, The Huffington Post, Health Central, and so on. But she writes about her own chronic condition, and she makes it clear at the beginning of the book, this isn't about the before and after. She is in the midst of a life of suffering, and so we'll talk with her about that later this hour. Again, This Too Shall Last, Finding Grace When Suffering Lingers. First, we'll take a look at some of the day's headlines. Former Vice President Joe Biden surged to victory on Super Tuesday contests across the South and beyond. Senator Bernie Sanders claimed gold with a sizable win in delegate-rich California, as expected, divvying up the map on the biggest primary day of the season and hinting a tight battle between the two could last for weeks or more. Well, after midnight on Wednesday, the Associated Press declared former Vice President Biden had narrowly defeated Sanders in Texas, the second biggest contest of the day, with 90% of precincts reporting he had led Sanders 33.3% to 29.3%. We'll have more details on this later. The two candidates are likely to receive a similar share of the state's 228 delegates. They are pledged there. Maine's race was too close to call earlier in the day. It has since been called for the former vice president with 71 precincts in that area. Senator Sanders and Biden were within 2 percentage points of one another. But the headline of the night was Biden's remarkable comeback after his recent poor performance in Iowa, New Hampshire, and Nevada. He won the most contests on Tuesday, and although he came out ahead in the delegate race, it remains unclear if the former vice president outperformed expectations for just a week ago. Next week's March 10th primary in Michigan, one of six states voting that day, will be Biden's next test as he seeks to demonstrate that he can reliably defeat Sanders' appeal in the Midwest. I'm here to report we are very much alive, the former vice president said, speaking to a very excited crowd. And make no mistake about it, he went on to say this campaign will send Donald Trump packing, the 77-year-old Biden, who told fired-up supporters in Los Angeles. Meanwhile, Mike Bloomberg's White House bid may be on the brink. In fact, he made an announcement earlier today that it is ended. We'll tell you more about that as well. Well, the billionaire former New York City mayor assessed his Mega Bucks campaign after a brutal showing on Super Tuesday races, his first appearance on the ballot, according to multiple reports. Despite dropping a staggering $500 million of his vast personal fortune on the race, Bloomberg, who's 78, barely rated at the voting booths in early Super Tuesday states, clenching a victory only in the tiny U.S. territory of American Samoa. According to NBC News and the Associated Press, his campaign officials deliberated over whether he should stay in the race after the disappointing results in multiple states. He decided he will not continue and threw his support behind the former Vice President Joe Biden. Well, the World Health officials confirmed Tuesday the fatality rate for the new coronavirus was at 3.4% globally. As Japan's Olympics minister said, there's a possibility the 2020 Summer Games in Tokyo could be delayed. The head of the World Health Organization announced the increase during a media briefing, which differed from the previously established global mortality rate of around 2%. In comparison, the death rate for the seasonal flu is far fewer than 1%, he said. And while many people globally have built up immunity to seasonal flu strains, COVID-19, which is what they officially call the coronavirus is a new virus to which no one has immunity. That means more people are susceptible to infection and some will suffer severe disease. There are more than 90,000 cases of the new coronavirus in at least 70 countries. More than 3,100 deaths have been reported around the world, including 9 here in the U.S., all in the state of Washington. The number of coronavirus infections in Japan reached 1,000 on Wednesday, with 706 of them being on the Diamond Princess cruise ship. Japan's health ministry reported 12 people had died from the virus so far. Minister Hashimoto implied the Olympics could be held later in the year, wouldn't have to start on their plan July 24th opening day. Well, the U.S. Supreme Court has given states latitude to prosecute illegal immigrants in a recent decision, and the Trump campaign is suing the Washington Post for false defamatory statements vis-a-vis Russia. Representative Devin Nunes is suing the Washington Post for a Russia-themed hit piece. And tension is rising as the U.S. death toll for the coronavirus reached 9. There was a press conference held earlier today in which the current vice president, flanked by the professionals who make up the coronavirus team, explained where the nation stands at this point. And the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention will drop limits on virus testing. Iran's has tripled its uranium stockpile. The IAEA chief is realizing the suspicion that the Trump administration had on Iran may in fact be correct. And Jeff Sessions forced into a runoff in the Alabama Senate primary. No one saw that coming. Maybe his opponent did. Dozens still missing following storms that killed at least 24. At this point, there are 36-38 people still unaccounted for. And a conversion therapy officially has been banned in the state of Virginia. It's sort of a term that was coined. It doesn't represent what has actually happened in most cases where counseling was sought. But nonetheless, in the state of Virginia, it has been officially banned. On this day in history, 1791, Vermont becomes the 14th state of the Union. 1793, George Washington is sworn in for a second term as president of the United States during a ceremony in Philadelphia. And on this date in history, 1865, President Abraham Lincoln is inaugurated for a second term of office. With the end of the Civil War in sight, Lincoln declares, "With malice toward none, with charity for all." He would not survive to serve that term. On this day in history, 1913, the Buffalo Nickel officially goes into circulation. And in 1925, on this very date, in the first national radio broadcast of an inauguration, U.S. President Calvin Coolidge's inauguration is heard live on 21 radio stations coast to coast. 1933, Franklin Delano Roosevelt takes office as America's 32nd president. And in 1952, on this day, Ronald Reagan and Nancy Davis are married in San Fernando Valley, California. 1994, in New York City, four Islamic extremists are convicted of the 1993 World Trade Center bombing that killed 6 people and injured more than 1,000. Finally, in 2019, on this day in history, doctors announce an HIV-positive man in Britain has become the second known adult worldwide to be cleared of the AIDS virus after he received a bone marrow transplant from an HIV-resistant donor. Later this hour, we will talk with K.J. Ramsey. This too shall last, finding grace when suffering lingers. You're listening to The Georgine Rice Show. We'll be back.
You're listening to The Georgine Rice Show podcast. It's aired on 93.9 KPDQ.
We're back 19 minutes after 4 o'clock. You're listening to The Georgine Rice Show. Well, they tell us to get ready for a long and grueling road ahead as Joe Biden and Bernie Sanders battle for the Democratic presidential nomination in a race that could possibly result in the country's first contested major party nomination convention in well over a half century. The former vice president surged to victory in the 5 Southern Super Tuesday states and beyond. Of supporters at the primary celebration speech in Los Angeles were ecstatic. "I'm here to report that we are very much alive," the former vice president said. Well, hours later, the Associated Press projected Biden the winner in Texas, which had a second largest cache of delegates on Super Tuesday. But Bernie Sanders, the populist senator from Vermont, who's making his second straight White House run, won California, the biggest prize on the day when 1/3 of all Democratic presidential convention delegates were up for grabs. "Tonight, I tell you with absolute confidence, we are going to win the Democratic nomination," he declared. One of the two of them has to be wrong. But now the race essentially a two-candidate contest, although There is a third person still in the running. Advances through a calendar that provides a promise and peril for both Biden and Sanders. Biden, once the unrivaled front runner for the nomination, was wounded after a lackluster fourth place finish in Iowa caucuses and a disappointing fifth place show in New Hampshire's primary. But a slight rebound in Nevada caucuses, that was a glimmer of hope, where he came in a distant second to Bernie Sanders, was followed this past weekend with a landslide victory in South Carolina's primary. The former vice president on Tuesday night spotlighted his comeback, with which came in large part thanks to his popularity among African Americans. To those who've been knocked down, counted out, left behind, this is your campaign. He said, speaking to supporters just a few days ago, the press and the pundits had declared the campaign dead, which, of course, it was, but for all intents and purposes. It may be over for the other guy, Biden added, referring to Bernie Sanders. Well, Mr. Sanders is yet to agree. Well, Biden's goal going into Super Tuesday was to stay close to Sanders in the delegate hunt and cement his status as a moderate alternative to the progressive senator. It appeared to be a mission accomplished. Now, the fact that he had several folks endorse him in the final days or hours before Super Tuesday may have helped. The comeback was fueled by a tidal wave of establishment consolidation behind him over the past 3 days, which included rival moderate candidate Senator Amy Klobuchar of Minnesota, former South Bend, Indiana Mayor Pete Buttigieg dropping out of the race, endorsing the former vice president. But with his victory in California, Sanders was also exuberant on Tuesday night, saying he was excited about where he is. "We have come a long, long way," he said, once the longest of long shots when he launched his first White House bid 4 years ago. "The next tests for the candidates will come next Tuesday when voters in six states, Idaho, Michigan, Mississippi, Missouri, North Dakota, and Washington State, head to the polls, and on St. Patrick's Day, March 17th, when Arizona, Florida, Illinois, Ohio have their say. Then Georgia will hold a primary on the 24th of this month." Former New York City Mayor Mike Bloomberg tried to put a pretty picture on what turned out to be a disappointing evening. He later this afternoon bowed out and threw his endorsement behind the former vice president. "As the results come in," he said earlier in the day, "no matter how many delegates we win, we've done something nobody thought was possible. We've gone from 1% to being a contender for Democratic nomination." Hours earlier, the multi-billionaire business and media mogul, who spent more than $500 million of his own money on the White House bid, boasted he had no intention of dropping out. Well, he's now dropped out. Meanwhile, Elizabeth Warren, who's still in the race, blames pundits. It was also a very tough night for her. She came in third to Biden and Sanders in her adopted home state of Massachusetts, ouch, and was projected to finish fourth in her native Oklahoma. Warren, one-time co-frontrunner with Biden, has suffered one disappointing finish after another since the start of the nominating calendar. She took direct hits at media pundits during a speech to supporters in Michigan. "What I see happening is a lot of folks trying to turn voting into some complicated strategy. You know, pundits, friends, neighbors, all are saying you have to second guess yourself on this. There's playing games about predictions and strategy, you know, guess what your neighbors are up to and so on." Well, it is something of a numbers game at any rate, and she did not play it well during Super Tuesday contests. Just as Bloomberg will now face a call from establishment Democrats and did step down, Sanders is now facing a similar pressure as well. In fact, Ilhan Omar of Minnesota, the representative, took a thinly veiled shot at Warren late Tuesday. A night earlier, she appeared on stage in Minnesota with Bernie Sanders. She questioned what would have happened if progressives consolidated last night like the moderates consolidated. Who would have won? Omar tweeted about the scenario. "That's what we should be analyzing. I feel confident a united progressive movement would have allowed us to hashtag build together and win Minnesota and other states we narrowly lost." Again, a thinly veiled suggestion that perhaps the only woman standing stepped down. And in a surprise moment at the end of his Dallas rally on the eve of Super Tuesday, former Vice President Biden called former Texas Representative Beto O'Rourke up to the stage and vowed to put him, who said that the government should forcibly seize assault rifles from Americans, in charge of gun control efforts. O'Rourke had endorsed Biden earlier in the day at that Dallas rally. Also at the rally, Biden accepted the endorsements of one-time rivals Pete Buttigieg, Amy Klobuchar, as the Democratic Party's moderate ring rallied around him. Ladies and gentlemen, tomorrow, speaking yesterday, I will be casting my ballot for Joe Biden, O'Rourke said, announcing to applause at the rally his intentions. Well, at this point, the former vice president has 553 delegates. Bernie Sanders, 488. Elizabeth Warren, 61. And Tulsi Gabbard, who is still in the race, has won. Three candidates have dropped out of the race, but also won delegates to the Democratic National Convention. They are former New York City Mayor Mike Bloomberg with 50 delegates, former South Bend, Indiana Mayor Pete Buttigieg with 26 delegates, and Minnesota Senator Amy Klobuchar with 7 delegates. So at the lineup of Super Tuesday states, former Vice President Biden won Alabama, Arkansas, Maine, Massachusetts, Minnesota, North Carolina, Oklahoma, Tennessee, Texas, and Virginia. Whereas his opponent, Mr. Bloomberg, won American Samoa, the only place he actually won overall. Bernie Sanders took California, Colorado. He also took Vermont. And again, contests will resume again in about a week. Meanwhile, there's a major battle going on over voter purges, and that's raging in some key states. According to Newsmax, major battlegrounds with sloppy record keeping have more names on their voter rolls than they have voting age adults. John Fund writes that President Donald Trump's reelection bid could be decided by people who don't belong on the voter rolls and may not even exist. That's no exaggeration, because advocacy groups are blocking voter purges designed to update voter registration rolls in the run-up to the November elections. Now, states have such sloppy record-keeping that the Public Interest Legal Foundation reports 244 U.S. counties in 29 states, plus the District of Columbia, have more names on their voter rolls than they have voting-age adults. Election experts warn fraudulent voter registrations can easily lead to illegal votes being cast. Well, voter roll maintenance generally involves removing voters who haven't cast a ballot in 3 to 4 years if they fail to respond to a written inquiry. Without those measures, good government advocates warn bloated voter rolls soon will include illegal residents, residents of other states, and people who have passed away. In Wisconsin, the judges there halted the removal of some 234,000 names from the state's voter lists. This despite federal laws mandating them to maintain reliable voter rolls. So there's something of a conflict there. But at least Wisconsin officials are trying to obey the law. In several other states, local officials have ignored statutes that require them to remove voters who have died, who have moved elsewhere, or are felons ineligible to vote. In several jurisdictions, post-Bush versus Gore, curbs on potential cheating are not being implemented because groups fight tooth and nail when some states try to follow the law. One salient example, the basis of for Democrat Stacey Abrams' claim that she was cheated out of the governor's race in Georgia in 2018, was that thousands of names that failed to meet state standards had been removed from the polls, or rather the rolls. The Justice Department has shown little interest in going after states for this problem with the polls. In 2009, then Deputy Assistant Attorney General Julie Fernandez allegedly told fellow prosecutors that the Obama administration would not be filing lawsuits under the federal law requiring local officials to purge illegitimate names from their voter rolls. In 8 years under Obama, no such lawsuits were filed. For some reason, the Department of Justice under Trump also has been regrettably leery of doing so. It's not as if these aren't cases ripe for action. In the first year in California's automatic voter registration law, over 100,000 people ended up on the rolls who didn't belong there, including illegal immigrants. Well, last year, Pennsylvania discovered at least 11,198 non-citizens were on its voter rolls due to a computer glitch that allowed ineligible voters to register. In Illinois, a similar scandal hit the news in January after the State Board of Elections admitted that at least 574 non-citizens had been allowed to register and in some cases vote after safeguards at motor vehicle bureaus failed. Almost all of the non-citizens turned themselves in after they were discovered that they'd been improperly registered, leading many to wonder how many others elsewhere remain unexposed. I can almost guarantee this will become an issue at immediately following the election, depending on the outcome and the closeness of the race. You're listening to The Georgine Rice Show. Up next, we're going to talk with K.J. Ramsey, the book, This Too Shall Last, finding grace when suffering lingers.
You're listening to the Georgene Rice Show podcast. It's aired on 93.9 KPDQ.
Hey, we're back. You're listening to the Georgene Rice Show. Now, when your prayers for healing haven't been answered, the fog of depression isn't lifting, your marriage is ending in divorce, or grief won't go away, it's easy to feel you failed God, or worse, that He's failed you. If God loves us, why does He allow us to hurt? Well, over a decade ago, chronic illness plunged my next guest, therapist and writer K.J. Ramsey, straight into this paradox. Before her illness, faith made sense, but when pain came and never left, she had to find a way across the widening canyon that seemed to separate God's goodness from her excruciating circumstances. She wanted to conquer suffering. Instead, she encountered the God who chose it. She wanted to make pain past tense. Instead, God invited her into a bigger story. She points out that our culture treats suffering like a problem to fix, a blight to hide, or the sad start of a transformation story. We silently, secretly wither under the pressure of living as though suffering is a predicament we can avoid or annihilate by having enough faith or trying harder. This Too Shall Last, her latest book, offers an antidote to our idolatry of effort and ease. Through personal stories and insights from neuroscience and theology, she invites us to let our tears become lenses of the wonder that before God ever rescues us, He stands in solidarity with us. The book is titled, This Too Shall Last, Finding Grace When Suffering Lingers. K.J. Ramsey is a therapist, a writer, recovering idealist who believes sorrow and joy coexist. Her writing has been published in Christianity Today, Relevant, The Huffington Post, Health Central, Catalyst, and Fathom magazine on the integration of theology, psychology, and spiritual formation. She and her husband live in Denver, Colorado. She joins us today to talk about her book, This Too Shall Last, Finding Grace When Suffering Lingers. KJ, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
You begin in the introduction of your book by pointing out that this book is not a before and after story. You're not writing from the vantage point looking back over a season of suffering that has ended with a happy ending. Describe for our listeners where you are now and where you were at the time you wrote this book.
Yeah, so, you know, the place that I was the time I wrote this book is pretty similar to where I am now. I live with a autoimmune disease called ankylosing spondylitis, and so I have a disease that's incurable and will be part of my life forever, but also I've experienced a lot of spiritual abuse, relational suffering, and those remain part of my story, and I always will. So when I chose to write the book, I was writing it because I couldn't find stories that were told from the vantage point of those who continue to be in their suffering. Most of the time when we talk about suffering, we talk about it as though it's past tense, mm-hmm. as though it's something we've overcome. And for people like me, which is a lot of us, most of us, even if it's not from the disease, sometimes our suffering stays until Jesus returns, and we need to be able to tell those stories too.
You write, I'm writing this introduction as cold immunotherapy drips steadily into my bloodstream to control a disease from which hundreds of people, including myself, have prayed for me to be healed. With an IV in my hand, nausea on my lips, and a room full of other sick people in my peripheral view, I'm well aware that some diseases aren't healed. Some hard things stay in our lives until Jesus returns, so I'm here to tell a story from the middle, where so many of us live, yet so few describe. I think it's a challenge, particularly in the Christian faith, to admit that sometimes suffering continues. And as I mentioned in the introduction, you found in the middle and are finding in the middle of your suffering God's grace and His presence. And those two things sometimes, particularly for those who have not suffered, seem like they contradict one another.
Yeah, it doesn't seem like they contradict one another because we have, I think, subconsciously welded together the American dream with the gospel.
Mm-hmm.
And Jesus himself actually said, you will have suffering in this world. We will. Paul and other writers throughout the New Testament talk about suffering as though it's something that we should expect and that it's really actually every Christian's inheritance. So if Jesus chose to be embodied and to suffer as a means of showing us his love, why would we expect that our lives would contain anything that is different. This becomes the place where I can know the presence of Jesus instead of a place that I just have to be rescued from or mm-hmm. get out of as quickly as possible.
Yeah, where you're just waiting for something to change before you can then begin to enjoy that deep relationship. You write, instead of claiming to have solutions, I'm inviting you to sit in the places where I've found sustaining grace. Grace that is upholding me even now while my world seems to fall apart yet again. I'm no rising hero. I'm a chronically ill 31-year-old who in the last decade has spent more hours sick on a couch than standing in the workforce. But it's on couches through tears that I've come to see that living with suffering that lingers can mean more fully receiving God's presence that lasts. Now, that is a very encouraging statement to those who, like you, are in the midst of suffering but have not yet experienced what you describe.
Yeah, and well, I think really physiologically, from the way that God made our brains and bodies for relationship, we can experience suffering as a place of God's presence and even his kindness, which I know sounds shocking and crazy. When we learn how to sit within it and rest within it and experience community and connection around it, instead of always focusing on how to escape from it or find the purpose in it. So when we are able to sit there and relax a little bit, it actually allows our brains and our bodies to become able to experience the calm that's needed to know the God who's already here.
Now, I know that there are some listeners, and you address this in your book, that say, why aren't you praying for healing? Why is it a lack of faith that your expectations no longer allow for the possibility that God would heal you? Can you address that up front? Because I'm certain it's running through the minds of some of our listeners today.
Right. Yeah, well, you know, I cannot tell you how many times I've heard people come to me and ask if they can pray for my healing, as though I've never, in 11 years of having a disease, prayed for that myself. The thing is, I do pray for healing, and I do yearn for the day when my body will be made new and whole, and I won't be broken like this anymore. But I also know that when my attention is aimed at only seeking relief, my brain and my body are not capable of experiencing my present life as a place where God is present. It's physiologically impossible when I'm constantly in a state of alarm and grasping to experience my body and my life as it is right now as a place where God is. And so I really try to invite people to see that perhaps if we could lament and we could be where we are, we might experience this greater miracle that God is with us.
Mm. You write that at 20 years old, with pain that could not be validated by a blood test or an X-ray, I began to feel less like a person full of potential and more like a number and a burden. And you make the point that pain threatens personhood, that one can become lost in this overwhelming, relentless condition. You have chosen to respond otherwise, but can you talk about how pain threatens personhood and one can lose oneself under that circumstance?
Absolutely. Yeah. So, I mean, the reason that we cry out for relief and that we yearn for healing is because we were made for love, not for pain. But pain itself causes sensations of internal disintegration. So when we're in pain, our brains send out cortisol. We become stuck in the fight, flight, freeze, or shake mode where we feel like we're in danger. And it's not just that we're going to die or that we're at risk of dying, but it's that we feel we are becoming less than ourselves because of the pain. So pain, I describe suffering as a threatening of our personhood because it threatens our capacity to really have perspective and to access the whole of our brain that keeps us regulated and calm and okay to make sense of our story. Wanting relief when we're in pain is not a problem. It's a consequence of being human.
Yeah, yeah. We're going to take a quick break, but we'll continue our conversation with K.J. Ramsey, author of This Too Shall Last, Finding Grace When Suffering Lingers. She writes beautifully, and In fact, it was a challenge to consider the conversation because you cannot duplicate what she's written. It's just very sensitive and beautiful, but we're doing our best. Anyway, we're going to take a quick break and we'll be back in just a few moments.
You're listening to the Georgene Rice Show podcast. It's aired on 93.9 KPDQ.
You're listening to the Georgene Rice Show, and I'm continuing my conversation with KJ Ramsey, author of This Too Shall Last, Finding Grace When Suffering Lingers. And that is a very challenging place to be, and that is where she has been for more than a decade. In the second chapter of your book, you write about warring storylines, that shame and solidarity are two different ends of the continuum when you're faced with the kind of chronic pain that you live with. Talk a little bit about how shame plays a role in suffering in this way, a shame that is perhaps imposed on you by others, or a sense that you shouldn't be in this position that you're in, or that you're unable to do other things. Can you talk a bit about that chapter?
Yeah, definitely. So, you know, I draw a lot from Dr. Kurt Thompson in my thinking about shame. It's actually that shame is detaching all of us at every moment of every day from the true story that God is here and God loves us. And so when we suffer and it doesn't go away, shame is actively trying to tell a story where we end up alone and mm-hmm. where suffering is the only thing that we will continue to experience. And it's really always a relational experience and an embodied experience. So shame is constantly at work trying to activate our bodies so that we feel like we are misunderstood, like we're being judged. And sometimes we really are, and I write about mm-hmm. some experiences of that in that chapter. But I think first and foremost, I like people to know that shame is actually operating in your life, no matter whether you are experiencing a disease like mine, depression, or just being human. Shame is always trying to tell a story where you aren't enough and where you're going to end up alone.
You write about the fact that we were made for relationship. I think about Job's friends who came alongside him but weren't particularly helpful. Talk about the role that relationship has played in your life of suffering, both for good or for ill, things that we ought to consider not doing when we are coming alongside someone with whom we are called to relationship.
So this is the really painful and the really hopeful part of what I'm trying to share with people. Mm-hmm. Relationships are often where we have experienced the most pain in our lives and in our suffering because of the hurtful things that people have said or the care that hasn't been given that should have been given. But because God made us relational to reflect who He is as Father, Son, and Spirit, the Trinity in relationship, relationships are also the place where we will experience the most healing and the most integration into wholeness. And so for me, that has looked like a lot of different things. It's looked like being honest about where I am, and that includes being honest about how weak I am sometimes, mm-hmm. being honest about my needs for physical help, just in stories I tell in the book of times when I needed help with dishes and walking to the bathroom, but also being honest about my need for spiritual strength, that when my faith is failing and it is weak and I can't have hope on my own, that I can have hope through others, that we really can, I think, spiritually and physiologically have faith on one another's behalf.
Yes,
I've experienced so much joy, so much grace in the presence of other believers, mm-hmm. but it usually involves embracing some really awkward conversations and embracing them having to see me in a weak state in which I would rather not be seen.
Has that gotten easier for you as time has passed, or perhaps as the need has increased to be vulnerable? And have you found that people respond well generally?
You know, in some ways it's gotten easier because I know what can happen, but it's still 11 years into this, I still bristle against my need for help. Mm-hmm. And so I still sometimes have to force myself to tell my closest friends how I'm really doing and when my body is especially really struggling. So yes and no, it's gotten easier because I know that the pain of being honest and of experiencing that vulnerability of being seen will be worth it eventually. I think that not everybody receives that well, and we have to be pretty wise in choosing safe, empathetic people to share our pain and struggles with. But I do know from experience that there are many people who are capable of standing with us in our sorrow, and that there is so much joy in that experience mm-hmm. of sharing our sorrow.
You, in one chapter titled Emotion, you write about being present to pain but receptive to grace. And that may be for those who suffer chronic pain. That may be a very difficult concept to grasp. Can you explain a bit about being present to pain, which is not an option for you and for others, but also being receptive to grace, how those two things somehow intersect?
Right. So like I was talking about a little bit ago, when we're in pain, our body's sending out alarm signals and neurochemicals that are saying, you're not okay, get out of here. And what I find is that both for pain like mine, but really pain like any of ours, pain that you experience in your story too, Georgine, that we are, when we are able to cry aloud to God from that place of need, we can then experience that he hears us. And that's where we become receptive to grace. So when we shift from only seeking relief and trying to minimize our pain or spiritualize it by finding a purpose for it, that we can experience God drawing near to us in our need. And that experience itself of need being met, not necessarily in the extinguishment of our deep sorrow, but in the comfort of Christ's nearness, that changes the very structure of our emotional memory, which ignites hope over and over again.
Mm. Well, I have to tell you, you write beautifully, and my challenge in doing interviews on a regular basis is you tend to have to quickly go through, you know, read a book very quickly. And I found that a challenge with your book because I wanted to stop and pause and consider longer than usual what you were saying, and I will certainly revisit that in the book. And I would highly suggest that listeners who are sharing a similar experience or who want to be able to minister to and come alongside those who suffer, that this is an excellent book to provide resource to that end. It's titled This Too Shall Last, Finding Grace When Suffering Lingers. KJ Ramsey, thank you so much for the book and for the time you've spent with us here today.
Thank you so much. So encouraged.
Appreciate it. She writes, and one day soon we will rise. We'll trade our places on this couch for honored seats around a table. We'll sit with bodies that no longer ache and minds that no longer fear. And instead of pain, we'll share laughter. The tears we needed to glimpse grace will be wiped away by Christ's tender, scarred hands. And we'll watch with wonder as God hurls death like a fireball into a fathomless sea never again to be seen. Wrapped in the bright linen of our perseverance, we'll see earth and heaven newborn. And from the silent spaces of sorrow within and between us will rise the most stunning song. Glory will be our sun. Joy will be our inheritance. God will be our king. With his words of well done still ringing in our ears, we'll look at each other's with smiles and see this couch was a throne all along. Again, from This Too Shall Last, Finding Grace When Suffering Lingers. KJ Ramsey is the author. The book is published by Zondervan and certainly worth a read. As I mentioned, I'll plan to revisit the book at a much slower pace because she writes beautifully and there's real depth there. Someone who has suffered for more than a decade and found God's grace in the midst of it. She has something to say. You're listening to The Georgine Rice Show. It's 5 o'clock. We've got news and traffic coming up, and then we'll be back.
You're listening to The Georgine Rice Show podcast. It's aired on 93.9 KPDQ.
We're back. You're listening to the second hour of The Georgine Rice Show. Glad to have you with us. By the way, looking forward to the Ignite Conference. That's coming up this Saturday. If you want to join us, you can show up, purchase your tickets. I think registration starts around 8:30. Go to westernseminary.edu/ignite for all the important details. So looking forward to that this weekend. And if you're there, be sure to come up and say hello, and I'll do the same. Well, at least 24 people are dead. 38 are still missing after tornadoes hit central Tennessee early Tuesday morning, according to state officials. A hit so fast, a lot of folks didn't have time to take shelter. The mayor, Randy Porter, said many of these folks were sleeping. And as we heard earlier, the tornadoes, and there were apparently two of them, were on the ground for 10 minutes. There was no time to be warned, and people just were caught up in it. Officials in Putnam County, which is one of the hardest hit areas, said children were among the dead. 13 in Memphis reported. At least two tornadoes blew through the state, and they caused significant damage near downtown Nashville and Putnam County, around 80 miles east of Nashville. Among the damage, with more than 100 destroyed, I should say amid, not among the damage. Let me just clarify that. Amid the damage was more than 100 destroyed buildings, downed power lines, a severely damaged airport. And by the way, it should have been were 100. Was singular, were plural. Anyway, John C. Toon Airport, Nashville's international sister airport in West Nashville, sustained significant damage due to severe weather. According to some on the ground there, we're still resilient and we're going to rebuild, the mayor said, but it's going to take some time. The number of missing was down from 77 earlier in the day, according to officials, along with a list of names posted on Facebook in Nashville. That's one of the challenges, is finding people who might be in the debris, who are perhaps in another area where they're getting finding shelter and care, but you can't communicate because, you know, people don't have access. So the number was 77. It's now down to 38, but 38 is still significant. Police and fire crews spent hours pulling survivors and bodies from wrecked buildings. The president plans to visit there on Friday. He sent his condolences to the state, saying, "I want to send my warm wishes to the great people of Tennessee." He was at the beginning of his speech at the National Association of Counties Legislative Conference. That was on Tuesday. "Our hearts are full of sorrow for the lives that were lost." Well, last night was a reminder about how fragile life is. The Nashville mayor, John Cooper, told reporters at a news conference Tuesday morning, and it should be a reminder of for us all. The governor has declared a state of emergency, sent the National Guard to help with search and rescue efforts in Putnam County. Early findings by the National Weather Service survey teams indicated that the damage in Nashville and Wilson County at the east was inflicted by a tornado of at least EF3 intensity. And as I mentioned, at least one of the two, if not both, touched down for a period of 10 minutes, which is a very long time when you're talking about that kind of destruction and strong winds. Meanwhile, health officials in Placer County, California, have confirmed the state's first coronavirus-related death in an elderly adult with underlying health issues. The news came on the same day, that Washington State reported an additional COVID-19 fatality, bringing the national death toll to 11. We extend our deepest condolences to the loved ones of this patient. The county health officer, Amy Sisson, said in a statement, "And while we have expected more cases, this death is an unfortunate milestone in our efforts to fight this disease, and one that we never wanted to see." Well, she said the patient tested presumptively positive on Tuesday and was likely exposed during international travel earlier in the month of February on a Princess cruise ship that departed from San Francisco to Mexico. The patient had been in isolation in Kaiser Permanente, Roseville, and again passed away. The first coronavirus-related death in the state of California, and of course another in the state of Washington. Well, a fired-up Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer appeared to issue a vague warning toward Supreme Court Justices Neil Gorsuch and Brett Kavanaugh on Wednesday during a rally held as the court held arguments in a high-profile abortion case. We talked to your about that yesterday. At the rally hosted by the Center for Reproductive Rights, Schumer noted that the case, June Medical Services LLC versus Russo, is the first major abortion case since the president's court picks have been on the bench. The dispute dealing with restrictions over who can perform abortions involves a Louisiana law similar to the one in Texas that the court ruled unconstitutional in 2016 before either Trump justice was on the Supreme Court, and before conservatives held a 5-4 majority. Now, essentially, this has to do with admitting privileges and training on the part of abortionists. Now, in the Texas case, there was not an example of abuse on the part of those performing abortions. In Louisiana, the story is somewhat different, and they offered a series, when the law was being passed there, a series of examples where abortionists were abusing their power or were not trained medical professionals at all. But Schumer warned, "I want to tell you, Gorsuch, I want to tell you, Kavanaugh, you have released the whirlwind and you will pay the price." Really? What is he talking about? What is this senator talking about is going to happen to these two sitting justices. You won't know what hit you if you go forward with these awful decisions. Again, what is he referring to? What is the consequence that he's referring to? Well, video of the remarks quickly circulated on social media, with Republicans casting the warning as a threat against two sitting Supreme Court justices, which apparently it was. Schumer didn't explain what price this would be as far as the justices are concerned, but reached for comment, his office said in a statement. It is a reference to the political price Republicans will pay for putting them on the court, and a warning that the justices will unleash a major grassroots movement on the issues of reproductive rights against the decision. Now, again, this is not an up or down vote on whether or not abortion on demand ought to remain legal in or is constitutional in the United States. It's whether or not in the state of Louisiana, where they have had a serious problem with, in quotes, abortionists abusing their power, whether or not they should be required to have admitting privileges and have a certain level of training. Well, during the rally, Schumer did go on to describe how Republican lawmakers could be impacted. We will tell President Trump and Senate Republicans who have stacked the court with right-wing ideologues that you're going to be gone in November and you will never be able to do what you're trying to do now ever, ever again, he said earlier in his address. He accused Republican lawmakers of waging a war on women and said reproductive rights are under attack in a way we haven't seen in modern history, which is such a gross overstatement. It's almost laughable, but he's not laughing. This is not the first time a Democratic senator issued vague warnings toward the Supreme Court. Back in August, a group of senators led by Senator Sheldon Whitehouse, a Democrat from Rhode Island, filed a brief in which he accused the court of being politicized, calling it not well and warning that if it does not heal itself, it could be restructured. Now, this was taken as a warning that the Democrats would attempt to pack the court by increasing the number of justices and loading the bench with liberals once a Democrat was in the White House. Now, there was an attempt to do that many years ago by a sitting president, and he was impeached. Well, the case before the court is part of a larger effort by red states to pass laws regulating abortion to test how supportive the new justices will be of precedents such as Roe versus Wade and Planned Parenthood versus Casey, which form the basis for abortion being legal in the first place. Well, the law in question requires abortion doctors in Louisiana to have admitting privileges at a nearby hospital in case a patient experiences complications during or after a procedure. Now, those backing the law argue that it regulates abortion providers similarly to how other medical providers are regulated by the state, while also ensuring doctors are competent. And my understanding is every other doctor in the state of Louisiana is required to have this admitting privileges, which is a bit higher level of competency required. Opponents say that it's targeted at abortion providers with a goal of shutting them down, citing a 2016 case out of Texas in which the Supreme Court invalidated a very similar law. But again, the difference between Louisiana and Texas, those arguments were heard by the court today. And of course, we won't hear any kind of a decision for months. But nonetheless, Schumer getting a bit exercised over the consequence that he says the Supreme Court justices will pay if they don't do his bidding in terms of how they rule in this case. 16 minutes after 5 o'clock, you're listening to The Georgine Rice Show.
You're listening to The Georgine Rice Show podcast. It's aired on 93.9 KPDQ.
We're back 21 minutes after 5 o'clock. You're listening to The Georgine Rice Show. I mentioned earlier that Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer had some rather threatening remarks to make about a couple of the Supreme Court justices. Well, in a very unusual, rare rebuke to Schumer's dangerous and irresponsible comments on Kavanaugh and Gorsuch, the Chief Justice Roberts has spoken. Well, he issued a highly unusual and forceful rebuke of the Senate Minority Leader. And if you've just joined us, Chuck Schumer called two of the Supreme Court justices out, saying that there would be a price to pay if they ruled on a particular abortion measure that came, not measure, but abortion question that came before them today. Well, wrote Chief Justice Roberts, this morning, Senator Schumer spoke at a rally in front of the Supreme Court while a case was being argued inside. He said in an extraordinary written statement, Senator Schumer referred to two members of the court by name and said he wanted to tell them that you have released the whirlwind and you will pay the price. You will not know what hit you if you go forward with these awful decisions. Now, they haven't made a decision. They just heard the oral arguments today. So what decisions, plural, he's referring to. But he's threatening that if they decide against Mr. Schumer's preference, that there's going to be a price to pay. Well, the Chief Justice went on to say, justices know that criticism comes with the territory, but threatening statements of this sort from the highest levels of government are not only inappropriate, they are dangerous. All members of the court will continue to do their job without fear or favor from whatever quarter, end quote. Well, hours earlier at a pro-choice rally hosted by the Center for Reproductive Rights, the minority leader ominously singled out President Trump's two Supreme Court picks. I want to tell you, Gorsuch, I want to tell you, Kavanaugh, you have released the whirlwind and you will pay the price. You won't know what hit you if you go forward with these awful decisions. Well, video of the remarks circulated on social media and the firestorm ensued. But it was a rare rebuke on the part of the Chief Justice to respond to the Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer's remarks on those steps. A federal judge earlier this week granted a request from a conservative watchdog group, Judicial Watch, to have former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton sit for a sworn deposition to answer questions about her use of a private email server to conduct government business. Well, the former Secretary of State argued that she has already answered questions about this and shouldn't have to do it again. But D.C. District Court Judge Royce Lambreth said in his ruling that her past responses left much to be desired. As extensive as the existing record is, it does not sufficiently explain Secretary Clinton's state of mind when she decided it would be an acceptable practice to set up and use a private server to conduct State Department business. Well, the judge went on to recognize that while Clinton responded to written questions in a separate case, those responses were either incomplete, unhelpful, or cursory at best. Simply put, her responses left many more questions than answers. Lambreth said that using written questions this time will only muddle any understanding of Secretary Clinton's state of mind and fail to capture the full picture, this delaying the final deposition of this case even further. Well, the ruling comes as Judicial Watch revealed in December of last year the status conference that the FBI released approximately 30 previously undisclosed Clinton emails, and that the State Department failed to fully explain where they came from. Well, the State Department has been pushing for discovery phase in the case to come to a close, but Lambreth said he's not ready to do so, saying that there's still more to learn. So the saga continues. There are lots of continuing sagas going on these days. Well, South Philadelphia residents are outraged that a nonprofit called Safe House had ambushed them by announcing with virtually no warning that it would open a supervised drug injection site in their neighborhood this week. One mother, concerned about walking her 6 and 10-year-old children past the injection site every day, called former Pennsylvania Governor Ed Rendell, chairman of Safe House, and Rhonda Goldfein, its vice president, sneaks. A local council member said that they were shocked and outraged that the facility would be placed in their neighborhood. One councilman said the facility flew under the city council's radar because the area already has been zoned for a medical facility. Johnson said the location was unacceptable because it would share space with two daycare centers and a senior center in less than 500 feet from a school. Doesn't seem like the best location. Well, the site would be placed where drug users can inject themselves with their drug of choice under the supervision of a doctor or a nurse who can, if necessary, administer an overdose antidote. Safe House says its facility also would provide recovery counseling, education, and referrals to social services. So someone who is addicted to drugs can walk in, be injected with whatever drug, illegal drug, illicit drug they choose, and walk out into an area where there are two daycare centers, a school, and a senior center within 500 feet. Not sure what the wisdom behind that decision might have been. Well, this would be the first such injection site in the United States, but reporters from ABC Action News 6 toured similar facilities in Canada. They found that although clean on the inside, the sites attract significant drug use and sales outside, both during and after operating hours. Well, that's shocking. They saw assaults and other crimes outside the facilities as well. Well, South Philadelphia's injection site was made possible when U.S. District Judge Gerald McHugh gave Safe House the green light in February to open. Well, the federal government had tried to stop the injection site by suing under a provision of the Controlled Substances Act, commonly called the Crack House Statute. The statute makes it unlawful to knowingly open, lease, rent, or use or maintain any place, whether permanently or temporarily, for the purpose of manufacturing, distributing, or using any controlled substance. It also makes it unlawful to manage or control any such place and intentionally make it available for others for the purpose of using illegal drugs. How on earth this managed to gain from a U.S. district judge the green light is a big question that the community and others of us have. Well, the plain language of that statute should have given the federal government an easy victory. Safe House acknowledges it is providing a place for drug users to use drugs. McHugh didn't say it that way. He explained Safe House, knows and intends that some drug use will occur on its property, primarily because that's the purpose of the Safe House. But it does not necessarily follow that the organization will knowingly and intentionally make the place available for the purpose of unlawful drug activity. Perhaps sensing his explanation made no sense, the judge tried to clarify by explaining that although Safe House intends people to use drugs at its injection site, where you inject drugs, the real purpose is reducing the harm of drug use, administering medical care, encouraging drug treatment, and connecting people with social services. Well, the objection, of course, isn't around any of those things. It's the injection of drugs and then walking out into the community where there are two daycare centers, a school, and a senior center in close proximity. Well, that's like saying that the purpose of a park isn't to provide a place to have picnics and play, but to reduce the harm of having picnics and playing in the street. Well, the federal government is appealing the decision. Always learning, never coming to the knowledge of the truth. Professing to be wise, very foolish. It's a sad day in America. All right, we're going to take a break here in just a moment. When we come back, we'll continue to wind our way through some of what's going on in the country. And later, we'll take a look at Pew Research study, I should say, of mainline churches and whether or not American Christianity is growing while mainline churches are declining and what that might mean. You're listening to The Georgine Rice Show.
You're listening to The Georgine Rice Show podcast. It's aired on 93.9 KPDQ.
Hey, we're back. You're listening to The Georgine Rice Show. Well, the U.S. Supreme Court announced on Monday that it's going to review a challenge to the Affordable Care Act's constitutionality after a group of states led by Texas claimed that there's no longer a legal justification for it. And this is no big surprise. The law commonly known as Obamacare, it's actually the Affordable Care Act. It was first upheld by the Supreme Court under the justification that by tying the individual mandate, the requirement to buy health insurance, to a financial penalty, it fell under Congress's taxation power. Well, when the Trump administration eliminated that penalty, Republican-led states claimed there's no longer a legal basis for the mandate. Now, if the Supreme Court's going to be consistent, and a lot of people thought the justification for allowing Obamacare as constitutional was flawed, if they want to follow that logic through, then it seems that Obamacare will be overturned. The Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals ruled in December that part of the law is now unconstitutional, and their decision cast a cloud over the rest of it. Well, says the ruling, the individual mandate is unconstitutional because it can no longer be read as a tax, and there is no other constitutional provision that justifies this exercise of congressional power. Now, the court sent the case back down to a lower court to decide on whether the mandate is severable from the rest of the law, which would allow other parts of Obamacare to survive. Well, a group of 20 Democratic states appealed. Defenders of the Affordable Care Act argued that the issues raised by the case are too important to let the litigation drag on for months or years in lower courts. A decision from the Supreme Court is expected, well, not until after the 2020 election. Well, the U.S. military conducted a defensive airstrike against Taliban forces in Afghanistan less than a week after signing an historic peace deal with the militant group. Again, this is a rather unexpected turn of events, although until an agreement is signed, until I suppose some of the details are worked out, I suppose it's not altogether surprising. But a U.S. military spokesman, Colonel Sonny Leggett, said in a tweet that the airstrike Wednesday was conducted against four Taliban fighters in one area in the Helmand province, who he said were actively attacking an Afghan National Defense and Security Force checkpoint. This was a defensive strike to disrupt the attack, he said. This was our first strike against the Taliban in 11 days. So this was relatively small and very focused. Well, Leggett, who called on the militant group to uphold their commitments to the peace deal signed on the 29th of last month, went on to say that the Taliban forces had conducted 43 attacks on Afghan troops on Tuesday in the same province. To be clear, he continued, we're committed to peace. However, we have the responsibility to defend our partners. And again, this is the Afghan National Defense and Security Force, or ANDSF. Afghans and U.S. And the U.S. have complied with our agreement. However, Taliban appears, or Talibs as they're called, appears intent on squandering this opportunity and ignoring the will of the people for peace. Well, Afghan's interior minister said 4 civilians and 11 troops were killed Wednesday in a wave of attacks attributed to the Taliban across the country in the past 24 hours. Afghan forces killed at least 17 Taliban members during those clashes as well. Well, the Taliban have not claimed responsibility for any of the attacks so far, and they've not commented on the U.S. airstrike. So things are, at least from our vantage point, at something of a standstill. Well, President Trump said yesterday that he spoke on the phone to the Taliban leader, making him the first U.S. president believed to have spoken directly to the militant group responsible for the deaths of thousands of U.S. troops in nearly 19 years of fighting in Afghanistan. The president told reporters on the South Lawn, I spoke to the leader of the Taliban today. We had a very good talk, end quote. He didn't provide any more details, but Taliban spokesman, whose name I won't attempt to pronounce, confirmed the president spoke with the Taliban leader, Mullah Abdul Ghani Barada. Taliban leaders and U.S. envoys signed the historic peace deal in Doha, Qatar. It lays out a condition-based path to the withdrawal of American forces from Afghanistan. Well, Secretary of State Mike Pompeo, who witnessed the signing of that agreement, was present at the time, told Brett Baer on Fox News Monday that the Trump administration was able to accomplish something the Obama administration could not. Question is, can the peace hold if there is a peace at all? He went on to say they never got the Taliban to break with al-Qaeda. They never got a commitment that says if I execute the following conditions based, if the violence levels come down, that is, if the security posture for the United States of America is reduced, then and only then will we deliver a commensurate footprint inside your country. Well, additional peace negotiations between the warring Afghan sides are supposed to begin on the 10th of March. However, Afghanistan's leaders have already rejected releasing some 5,000 Taliban prisoners ahead of the launching of those talks. It was a precondition, which the military says was part of the U.S. agreement. So it is a fragile agreement at best, as elements of it have been rejected. And of course, the event that took place between the Taliban and Afghan forces. Well, North Korea fired a presumed short-range ballistic missile on Monday, just days after its leader, Kim Jong-un, supervised artillery drills aimed at testing the combat readiness of some of its units. Now, South Korea's Joint Chiefs of Staff revealed the projectiles were fired from an area near the coastal town of Wonsan and flew about 149 miles northeast on an apogee of about 22 miles, according to the Associated Press. They told reporters they're presumed to be short-range ballistic missiles, although that's not confirmed. The South Korean and U.S. militaries are said to be analyzing those launches even now. Well, the launch was the first of its kind by North Korea in 2020, which could signify the Hermit Kingdom might be resuming weapons demonstrations after a months-long hiatus that may have been forced by the coronavirus epidemic in Asia. Now, the rogue leader, who late last year announced he was no longer obligated to comply with a self-imposed moratorium on testing weapons, gave no clear indication of when he would resume testing or what this whole thing was about. Well, North Korea likely tested one of its new road mobile solid fuel missile systems or a developmental super large multiple rocket launcher it repeatedly demonstrated last year. That's according to an analyst from Seoul's Institute for Far Eastern Studies. Experts are saying such weapons can potentially overwhelm missile defense systems and expand the North's ability to strike targets in South Korea and Japan, including U.S. bases in both places. Well, South Korea's presidential office said National Security Director Chung Ai-yong discussed the launches with the South's defense minister and spy chief, and that the officials expressed strong concern over the North's resumption of testing activity, which could raise military tensions. Well, Japan said that it had not detected any projectile landing in its territory or its exclusive economic zone, and that no sea vessels or aircraft had been damaged. Well, the repeated firings of ballistic missiles by the North is a serious problem for the international community, including Japan, and the government will continue to gather and analyze information and monitor the situation to protect the lives and property of its people, the defense minister said in a statement. Well, Kim Jong-un's latest show of force is apparently aimed at boosting military morale, strengthening internal unity, and showing that his country is doing fine despite outside worries of how the North would contend with the outbreak. North Korea said in previous years has intensified testing activities in response to springtime military exercises between South Korea and the United States that it has described as invasion rehearsals. But the allies announced last week that they were postponing their annual drills due to concerns about the coronavirus outbreak in South Korea, with soldiers from both countries being infected. Well, the deadlock is larger nuclear negotiations with the administration, and Kim Jong-un has suspended virtually all cooperation with South Korea in the past months while demanding that Seoul defy U.S.-led international sanctions and restart inter-Korean economic projects that would jolt the North's broken economy. That has not yet happened. You're listening to The Georgine Rice Show. We're going to be back in just a moment. When we do, we'll talk about Joel Rosenberg commenting on the Israeli election results that show Netanyahu had a big night, but he questions whether or not it was enough. Also, mainline churches are in decline while American Christianity is growing. We'll tell you more about a Pew research study on that very topic. You're listening to The Georgine Rice Show.
You're listening to The Georgine Rice Show podcast. It's aired on 93.9 KPDQ.
We're back. You're listening to the final segment of The Georgine Rice Show. Taking a quick look at what's coming up tomorrow, we're going to talk with Than Bennett, author of My Fame, His Fame, Aiming Your Life and Influence Toward the Glory of God. There's a foreword by Mark Batterson. Than Bennett and his wife, Brooke, they live in Fort Washington, Maryland, with their three children. The Bennetts are longtime members of the National Community Church family in Washington, D.C. He's the director of government affairs for the American Centers for Law and Justice and is a regular on-air contributor to the daily syndicated radio program, J. Seculo Live. So the name may sound familiar to you, but we'll be talking about his book tomorrow on the program. Again, My Fame, His Fame, Aiming Your Life and Influence Toward the Glory of God. Well, enough already, so says Joel Rosenberg. After three rounds of elections in just 12 months, Israel urgently needs a fully functioning and stable government, not a paralyzing caretaker government. Well, incredibly, given the inconclusive results of the vote that took place on Monday, some Israeli politicians and pundits are already talking about a possible fourth round of elections. So if you're tired of what's happening here, if you are discouraged by all the back and forth, it could be worse. Well, Joel Rosenberg, he suggests absolutely not on a fourth round. He writes that Israeli voters are sending a clear and consistent message. We aren't giving full power to either the right or the left wing blocs for a reason. We want true statesmen to step up and form a broad-based national unity government that will put the needs of the nation ahead of petty and exhausting partisanship. What a concept. He writes that the reasons are obvious. We are grave and rising threats. We see them from Iran and terrorist organizations like Hezbollah, Hamas, and Al-Qaeda, ISIS, and others. We see rockets continuing to be fired at us from Gaza and know that the prospect of a third war with Lebanon is steadily growing. Again, Joel Rosenberg on the now concluded third round of elections in Israel. He writes that at the same time, we see historic once-in-a-lifetime opportunities emerging. It's clear that Israel has the chance to forge better relations and possibly full-blown peace treaties and trade relationships, not with the Palestinian leadership, unfortunately, but with Gulf states like Bahrain, the United Arab Emirates, Oman, and Saudi Arabia. Meanwhile, we realize that President Trump is the most pro-Israel leader in American history and that we must seize the moment to work with him to further strengthen the U.S.-Israel strategic alliance and advance regional peace while we have the chance. After all, there's an election coming up here. What if Trump is not in the White House next January, he asks. What if he is replaced by Senator Bernie Sanders, which seems less likely after the outcome of Super Tuesday, the most hostile and anti-Israel presidential candidate to ever emerge as a front runner. As the smoke fades from yesterday's vote, one thing is clear. Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and his right-wing Likud party had a very good night. With some 97% of the vote counted, Netanyahu's team appears to have won 36 seats in Israel's parliament known as the Knesset. That's up 4 seats from the September 2019 elections. By contrast, Netanyahu's main rival, Benny Gantz, the former chief of staff of the Israeli Defense Forces and founder of the centrist Blue and White Party, appears to have won only 32. Again, 36 to 32. That is Gantz's worst showing thus far. It's a loss of 1 seat from September and down 3 seats from April of 2019. Well, the good news for Netanyahu, already Israel's longest-serving premier, yet facing trial on 3 separate corruption indictments that begins on the 17th of March, is that he is on track to be given the first opportunity to form a government. The problem is that the right-wing parties appear to have won a combined total of only 59 seats. That's 2 seats short of the number needed to create an operating majority in the 120-seat Knesset. So the drama continues in Israel, and it may or may not be resolved in the short term. It typically takes weeks rather than days to resolve these issues, unless, of course, Netanyahu can pull together sufficient numbers to give him a clear victory in the Knesset. Well, with mainline denominational churches in America continuing to decline in size and number, is this a sign that the U.S. population is becoming more secular and less religious? Well, according to recent data from Pew Research, the answer actually appears to be no. Even as mainline churches have declined, non-denominational churches have experienced significant growth. In 1998, the number of non-denominational churches in the U.S. was 54,000. By 2012, the number had increased by 42% to 84,000. Now, is this just a matter of people leaving a mainline denomination and going to a non-denominational church, or does this represent new growth? To what should we attribute both the decline in the mainline churches and the growth in non-denominational churches? Well, the answer to the first question appears to be in large part related to generational changes. As the expectations and demands of a younger generation of society changes, people's expectations and demands for churches change as well. Older denominational models that fail to adapt and reach out invariably lose people. As Wheaton College professor Ed Stetzer observes, sometimes churches die and sometimes they should. A new church, not a reboot of the old, should be started in its place. Writer Erica Anderson has argued that the leaders taking Mr. Stetzer's advice generally focus on creating churches that cater to specific needs. There is a church exclusively for employees of Disney's World. Spanish language services are more popular than ever. House churches composed of neighbors meeting for informal services, usually in living rooms, are on the rise as well. Popular Christian leaders like Francis Chan, a former megachurch pastor, who now advocates house churches, offer free training for the model. However, within the changing American church landscape, an obvious tension is raised. How much can the form and practice of a church change without the core faith message being compromised? One need look no further than former Democratic presidential candidate Pete Buttigieg, who declared that his openly homosexual lifestyle was completely compatible with his declared Christian faith as a Baptist. In fact, he went so far as to declare that anyone holding to the historic and biblically consistent sexual ethic was at odds with being a loving Christian. So while it's true that Christian denominationalism is on the decline and non-denominationalism is on the rise, this may only be viewed as either a positive or a negative development, depending on whether this change is leading people to the worship of God in spirit and truth, since humankind is inherently religious by nature. That the American religious and church landscape is changing should come as little surprise. The more important consideration is what these changes reveal about what Americans are seeking to worship. Are more Americans moving toward worshiping a God who comports with their own imaginations and desires, or are they responding in genuine faith, seeking to worship God as he has revealed himself through his Son, according to the scriptures? We'll leave that an open question. Once again, coming up tomorrow on the program, we're going to talk with Than Bennett. He is a person whose voice is heard on the regular broadcast of the American Center for Law and Justice, J. Seculo Live program. His book is titled My Fame, His Fame, Aiming Your Life and Influence Toward the Glory of God. So I hope you will join us for that. I want to thank James Blend for producing today's program, Clark Hilden for engineering, and thank you for making the Georgene Rice Show part of your important day. Have a great night.
Thanks for listening to the Georgene Rice Show podcast. If you'd like to download a podcast of the show or would like more information on today's guests, please visit the show at kpdq.com or on Facebook. Follow the show on Twitter at GRiceShow and like us on Facebook. And join us live every weekday at 4 for more critical thinking for critical times on 93.9 KPDQ.